The following is a collaborative episode of both the original unoriginal podcast and Cinemantics. Enjoy. Yes. Hello, America, how are you? Hello, my name is Jeff Hedley.
And I'm Nick Melton.
And welcome to yet another, seems to be a holiday tradition, collaborative edition of the Original Unoriginal Podcast.
And Cinemantics, the podcast about movies, good and bad, mostly bad. I don't know why I went with that tone of voice.
Yeah, I don't know either. We're coming to you, of course, on my end with another edition of our sub-series of the best movie of all time. And Nick is just doing his usual thing.
Yep, because mine's movies anyways.
Yeah, that's why people like you more. You have higher subscription rates and better download numbers.
I don't know if I have higher subscription rates. Do we want to get into this on the air?
Maybe we shouldn't.
Maybe we shouldn't. I don't know what... I mean, my subscription rate is not terrible, but it's not, like, ridiculously high. Just a lot of people have downloaded the Dawn of the Dead episode.
That's true.
Doesn't necessarily mean I'm any better than you.
Okay. Anyway, folks, as it is, today is the 4th of July, or it will be when this is posted.
Bazing.
It's about time that we did something ridiculously appropriate. And this is something that I've always wanted to do with a podcast, and of course I didn't have much time to wait. You realize we've only been doing this show for, it's not even been a year.
No, this show, Cinemantics, premiered in October of last year.
So, I mean, this is just it wasn't that long of a wait. It just seemed like forever.
Right. But you started.
Yeah, but there was a hiatus.
There was an extended hiatus, but.
You know what, Nick? This isn't important. Because you know what is important?
This movie?
Today's film, which is, of course, from 1996, directed by Roland Emmerich. And this is.
Independence Day,
also known as ID4. You were so ready for that.
I was ready for that. Because I was going to do it first if you didn't.
Yes.
But you beat me to the punch, so.
So, I think I'm just going to open with this statement right now.
Okay.
This is, I think this is easily the most incontrovertible Roland Emmerich film ever.
Why do you use the word incontrovertible?
Because you can't really, I don't think someone, I couldn't watch this movie and see where someone could say this movie is terrible.
I don't think anyone would say it's a terrible movie. I mean, you look at his output since Independence Day. You have Godzilla, which a lot of people did think was terrible, but you love.
I love it.
And I find it enjoyable in that way, that I like movies like that. The Day After Tomorrow and 2012. Did he do anything else? Stargate. I haven't seen Stargate.
10,000 BC.
Ah, yes, the one everyone forgot because no one went to go see it.
Exactly.
Okay, yeah, this is back in the classic era of Roland Emmerich when he had Dean Devlin with him.
Dean Devlin, who he needs to reconnect with because the only time he's had any success, really...
As a filmmaker
is with Dean Devlin, yeah. Stargate, Independence Day, I would argue Godzilla.
Godzilla's not a terrible movie.
It's really not. It's just a...
You know, Roland Emmerich's movies are just big-budget B-movies.
They really are.
So if you like classic B-movies, you should like Emmerich movies, because they're basically the same thing, just with better special effects.
Yeah, I mean, in 2012, a dog walking a tightrope is no more ridiculous than...
anything that happens in this movie.
Or I was going to say, like, anything in, like, The Towering Inferno or The Poseidon Adventure.
Yeah.
You know, like, what's her name, diving into the thing and saying shit?
Perhaps Roland Emmerich was born, like, 3 decades too late.
It's possible, but
he
seriously...
He might have fit right in with the disaster.
What actress am I thinking of?
I don't know.
She was an old lady, and she dove into the water, and she said terrible things.
I don't know what
in,
you're talking
in
about.
The Towering Inferno, or the... I don't remember which one. We're really off topic.
I don't think I've seen The Towering Inferno or The Poseidon Adventure.
I haven't either. What do we want to do here first, cast or plot?
I think everyone knows the plot, so let's just summarize the plot right offhand. It's about aliens!
Yes, an alien invasion taking place on July 2nd through July 4th of a given year.
If you don't remember the iconic shot of the White House getting blown up, then you must not have lived in the 90s.
It's true.
That's all I can say. I mean, how many times did we have to see that? Like, it's just one of the defining movie moments of the 90s is watching the White House get blown up.
Yep.
Like, they didn't do it over... Surprisingly, when the aliens blow up the cities, like, they don't... they don't show any other major landmarks getting blown up. Like, the building they blow up in L.A. is, like, just some random building, and the building they blow up in New York is just a skyscraper. Like, the White House is the only, like, real monument that the ships park on top of.
It's true.
So, you saw the White House getting blown up in every trailer for this movie.
Or, if you were watching the NBA Finals in 1996, you repeatedly saw Harry Connick Jr., holy God, staring off into the distance.
Or Will Smith going, I have got to get me one of these!
Yeah.
Those are iconic things in trailers.
Yeah.
Not the best Roland Emmerich trailer, but...
I think it was effective. I have that it's turned down on its own. I did that on purpose so that it wouldn't, so the fan wouldn't come on.
Ah, that is a nifty trick.
Yes, it is.
Do that. Okay.
But anyway, they don't know what's going on.
They don't. We're turning our screens down to less brightness so that we don't overheat our computers.
Exactly. We're gonna take a chance today.
We are.
But let's talk about cast. I think that would be
all right. Well, there's the aforementioned Will Smith.
Yes.
Who is top billed here as Captain Stephen Hiller. We actually didn't do the plot. Aliens invade and blow things up, and we have to figure out a way to stop them.
Yeah.
This movie's been out since 96. If you haven't seen it, well, why haven't you?
Yeah.
It was like, I imagine it did tremendous box office.
Oh, yeah. It was, I want to say it was the number one of all time for a short period.
Of all time? Well, we'll look that up in a minute.
It was certainly the top grossing film of 96.
Well. For good reason.
Yes.
Will Smith is Captain Stephen Hiller. Bill Pullman as President Thomas J. Whitmore.
But they call him James. James Whitmore.
That might be what the J stands
I know,
for.
I'm just saying.
Jeff Goldblum as David Levinson, a.k.a. Ian Malcolm, just in a different movie.
Yeah. Well, I mean, he's a lot less of a womanizer and a bit more okay with science.
Right. Mary McDonnell as President Roslyn. Oh, wait. First Lady Marilyn Whitmore.
Yes. You haven't finished watching BSG, so you might
but I know who that she's President
I'm
Roslyn.
Just saying you might want to tread carefully before I spoil anything.
All right. Judd Hirsch as Julius Levinson.
Certainly the Jewiest character in the film.
Oh, yes. And, of course, I love that I get to say this on the air, Robert Loggia as General William Gray. Randy Quaid as Russell Case.
A drunken crop duster.
Margaret Collin as Constance Spano. Spano?
Spano. Yes. That's Jeff Goldblum's ex-wife. Or whatever she is.
She doesn't even have her own picture on IMDb.
Yeah.
Vivica Fox is Jasmine Dubrow.
The fiancé of Captain Stephen
Hiller.
I make
her sound Russian, but she's actually an African-American stripper.
Yes.
James Rebhorn as Albert Nimzicki.
The Secretary of Defense.
That guy. Okay.
Yes.
Harvey Fierstein as Marty Gilbert.
The gay Jew.
Who has that really distinctive raspy voice. You'd recognize it if you heard it.
Yes.
Adam S. Baldwin as Major Mitchell.
Or Colonel John Casey, as it were.
I really wish it was John Casey.
I know.
It was just like on that TV show, Chuck. It's just the same character 10 years later.
Let's hit a little harder.
What?
He's a little harder on Chuck. He's
yeah,
a little more...
he is. Well, the years will do that to you.
Yes, yes.
Brent Spiner as Dr. Brackish Oaken. That's the most improbable name in history, I think.
I guess.
No one names their child Brackish.
No.
That's an adjective.
It is.
Anyway, most people will know Brent Spiner as Data on Star Trek The Next Generation.
Yes.
So it's interesting to see.
And as the villain from The Master of Disguise. Nobody saw that. Nobody.
Including
nobody
me.
Saw that. Oh, did you see it?
I didn't.
Oh, okay.
Including me. I did not see it.
All right.
Where was I? James Duval as Miguel Cass.
Case. That's the Hispanic,
Keanu
Reeves.
They both have about equal acting ability, which is to say none at all.
Yes.
Lisa Jacob as Alicia Case.
That's the slutty daughter.
Giuseppe Andrews. That's a weird name. As Troy Case.
Young kid. A young son of Randy Quaid. We should stop right now. We should continue, but I just want to point out, I mean, this is classic B-movie, disaster movie shit, where it's just a packed cast.
Yeah, this is actually the only problem I would have with this movie, is that the cast is so big that, like, the movie, well, we watched the special edition this time, which I'd never seen, but I felt the movie was 30 or 40 minutes too long. It didn't need to be that long, but they had such a huge cast that they had to make sure they were touching on all the characters when appropriate.
Yeah.
So maybe it doesn't need such a large cast. But, I mean, I guess a bunch of them do die at the beginning when the aliens blow up the
city. It's also just the extended edition, so we can't really...
Right, that too. Ross Bagley is Dylan Dubrow.
Ross Bagley, most people know, he played the youngest cousin on Fresh Prince of Bel-Air with Will Smith. And, of course, he was Buckwheat in Little Rascals.
Bill Smitrovich as Lieutenant Colonel Watson.
I don't know who that is. I think that's the guy that you kept recognizing and couldn't figure out who.
Maybe. I don't care about any of these people because I don't recognize their names.
Harry Connick Jr., sir.
Well, he's at the top. I was going to get to him. Harry Connick Jr. is Captain Jimmy Wilder.
Yes. Would you like to hear some interesting trivia about that character?
Yes.
Would you like to know who was originally going to play that part?
Who?
TV's Matthew Perry.
Really?
Yes.
Oh, John Capades as Mario.
Yeah. the owner of a strip club.
The bittest of bit parts, but it's John Capades, so I felt like that warrants...
And nobody asked him any questions.
This is the biggest cast list I've ever seen.
But the thing is, like, there are notable people kind of all the way through in various fashions.
Jim Pittock as Reginald.
Yes, Andrew Keegan as Older Boy.
That's a great role.
You wanted to stop with the cast.
Frank Welker as special vocal effects.
He's probably the voice of the aliens.
No, alien vocal effects are by Gary A. Heckler.
Oh, well then who the hell was he?
Special vocal effects voice.
Okay.
Not helpful.
Dean
Devlin is Eagle 2 pilot, uncredited.
Do we need to go through any more of this?
No, not really. I'm just going through.
The point is,
this far down, I'm seeing pictures.
This movie has a redonkulous cast.
Radonkey Kong. MC Scat Cat.
Raw Dog.
All right, I'm going to exit this little window. I apologize for the click in advance.
Yes.
Let's see here. Its gross revenue was $817,400,891, and the budget was $75 million.
And they actually did quite a bit with that $75
million. They did. The special effects look great.
And they
what is it with these 90s blockbusters? The special effects hold up really well today, and so many other movies since then.
Well, I'll tell you the truth, because I remember seeing a making of thing about this movie. This movie, believe it or not, the majority of what we saw was practical effects.
That's the way to do it.
Yeah.
I mean, whenever you look at a CGI spaceship, you're always like, oh man, that looks so cool, and then 2 years later you're like, oh, that sucks. But these still look pretty good.
Indeed.
And they rarely use CG in this film. The fan is on your computer?
The fan is on. The listeners of Cinemantics can't tell, but my computer, yes, the fan is on, so I'm going to hold it in my hand for a while. That's what she said.
Anyway, it did some mighty banging numbers at the box office.
Certainly did.
And I like that.
The thing is, I didn't see this movie in the theater.
I don't think I did either.
It's weird. You know, you know me. I'm obsessed with films, and I know a lot about movie history and about the numbers and release dates and all that crazy shit from my childhood and growing up. But I tell you, this movie did not make a big... It just didn't seem like a big deal to me that summer. No one I knew was talking about it. Like, it wasn't a big deal. And I was, I was 9 years old at the time. You would expect that some of my classmates would have been losing their shit about this, like, you know, in the, when school started back, you know. But nobody said a word about this movie. You know, we were all obsessed with in the summer of 96, Harriet the Spy.
Oh, I remember that.
I'm just saying, like, that was our universe as children. We didn't even consider Independence Day. And I didn't even realize this movie... I kind of didn't realize this movie existed after those commercials with Harry Connick Jr. until I randomly got it in my stocking at Christmas that year.
I would have been pushing on the age of 11 at this point. I was 10, but approaching 11. So I would have been old enough to see it. And maybe I did, but I have no memory of seeing it. But I do remember at some point... I saw it as a kid, and it became, like, one of the defining films of, you know, the years of between being 10 and 15, you know? Like,
yeah.
We watched this movie countless times and had lots of toys and stuff.
I'm sure you did.
You said you were not one for action figures, but I'm going to go off on a little personal thing for just a sec.
All right.
When I was a kid, we didn't like action figures either. We liked aliens and creatures. Our toy basket was not so much a basket of toys as a creature basket. So, of course, everything from Independence Day made it up in there. Including the awesome aliens.
That you could split open and see the inside?
You know, well, the way it worked was, like, it was a big figure of the alien suit, and you could move the arms and tentacles and stuff, and there was, like, a little...
you could push these tabs on the back of the head, and it would make the head push open, and there was a little alien inside that you could take out and play with. But who wanted to play with the little alien? Because it's not as badass.
Yeah.
Yeah?
It's creepy.
It's creepy. The alien design in this film is awesome.
Yeah, I mean, you gotta love any time that someone is able to create an alien design that you would have just never considered.
And the thing is, it's an interesting design because it's not like any other alien you've seen before, and yet it harkens back to classic alien designs. It's still got, like, the little black almond-shaped eyes, the big head, the small body. It's just, it does things with those standard tropes that not many other alien designs do. Like, for example, they don't really have well-formed hands or feet. They've mostly just got claws. They have a giant head because they're telepathic, not because they have a giant brain. Although I guess they have a giant brain.
Yeah.
But they would presumably need it for communication, not necessarily because they're more intelligent than we are. We could assume, I guess, they're more intelligent because their technology is so advanced, but maybe they just existed longer than we have.
It's entirely possible.
So, anyway, cool alien design. Where do you want to go from here?
I don't know. It's interesting. You know, I've wanted to cover this movie since I started covering movies, and yet I don't have as much to say about this as I thought I would, because you know what? The thing is, this is a genuinely good movie.
Yeah, it's easier to pick apart things that suck.
Not just things that suck, but I mean things that have these really, really gaping flaws. And the truth of the matter is, I can't find gaping flaws in this movie. I can find little minor flaws when they happen, but not like in the after-the-fact conversation. Like, I think this movie is pretty damn awesome.
It's true. And many of the flaws that I was pointing out while I was watching the movie, they would address like 10 seconds later.
Exactly.
On screen. So it's like, it's not like these things didn't occur to the filmmakers. They thought it through and came up with reasons why these little plot contrivances should work. Like, I was thinking, why are they sending Jeff Goldblum up in the alien spaceship to deposit the computer virus? Don't they want to send a military guy up there?
And literally, like, the second you say that, Margaret Collin walks up like, why are you going?
Why can't they just train someone?
Yeah.
It's like, well, they won't know what to do if it goes wrong. I'm like, okay, I accept it. I just want them to address the problem.
Yeah.
And they did. Maybe this would be a good time for you to expound on the virtues of Dean Devlin being involved in the writing.
Well, I mean, it's just look his track record. Dean Devlin was a Roland Emmerich's, you know, a collaborator for Stargate, this, and Godzilla. Admittedly, there was a third person involved with Godzilla. I don't remember who, but we have to assume that the things that are wrong with that movie are probably that person's fault. Although, I mean, Roland Emmerich on his own has proven that he's not that great either. I hate to say it, but it's true. But Dean Devlin, I mean, I don't know, just what more can you say? I mean, like, Stargate. I haven't seen Stargate, but I mean, I watched Stargate SG-1. But I haven't seen Stargate, but I mean, Stargate is a movie that people don't shit on, you know. This is a movie that most people don't shit on. Godzilla, a lot of people shit on it. And I mean, this is not the place to really talk about this, but as I've said many times before, I think the real fault of Godzilla lies with the casting. Because I love Matthew Broderick, but that was the Matthew Broderick that had spent way too many years on Broadway and did everything really overly expressive. You know, they needed, like, Ferris Bueller era Matthew Broderick to make that movie work. Or they needed who they originally cast in the part but had to drop out for whatever reason, Jeff Goldblum.
That would have been a much better movie.
Yes, it would.
Ah, man, people would have loved Godzilla a ton more if it were Jeff Goldblum.
Exactly.
You know, looking at, like, the critical reception of this film, the shot of the White House's destruction has been declared a milestone in visual effects and one of the most memorable scenes of the 1990s. So I'm glad I'm not the only one who jumps to that conclusion. But you know how we were just talking about the special effects?
Yeah.
Several prominent critics expressed disappointment with the quality of Independence Day's special effects. Newsweek's David Arndt Anson claimed that the special effects were of no better caliber than those seen 19 years earlier in Star Wars. Todd McCarthy of Variety felt the production's budget-conscious approach resulted in cheesy shots that lacked in quality relative to the effects present in films directed by James Cameron and Steven Spielberg. Roger Ebert cited a lack of imagination in the spaceship and creature designs as one of the reasons for his marginally negative review, and Gene Siskel expressed the same sentiment in their on-air review of the movie. Despite this, though, the movie won the Academy Award for visual effects.
Yes, and I'm going to take on Ebert because I like to do that, you know. He talks about it being like stereotypical designs. I think part of that is the fact that, I mean, they do bring up Roswell, New Mexico, the Roswell UFO sightings, as being sort of part of this story.
And it turns out it is part of the story.
Exactly. And the thing is, you know, whenever people think of Roswell, there's always that same image of, you know, the saucer-shaped ship and the aliens with the big black almond-shaped eyes. And I think what they've done here with this movie is they've just taken that and they put a few original spins, and I feel enough of original spins on it, that it's not that simple. There's a lot more to it than that, you know.
Well, yeah, I think he failed to consider that it's supposed to be the Roswell aliens. And I think that's why they felt the need to design the suits for the aliens, so that they could incorporate those classic designs and still have something new on screen.
Exactly.
Let's see, what else is there for this? Well, we already know. Independence Day was the highest grossing film of 1996. In the United States, Independence Day earned $104.3 million in its first full week. So it made back its whole budget in a week.
Yep.
Including $96.1 million during its five-day holiday opening and $50.2 million during its opening weekend. All three figures broke records set by Jurassic Park 3 years earlier. That film's sequel, The Lost World, claimed all three records when it was released the following year. Independence Day stayed in the number one spot for 3 weeks and would gross, you know, whatever I said, blah, 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 that huge number.
800-something million.
800-something million. The combined total of that $816 million once trailed only the worldwide earnings of Jurassic Park as the highest of all time. It has since been surpassed by several 21st century films and currently holds the 23rd highest worldwide gross for a movie of all time. So, yes, it was a major box office success.
Huge hit.
And it has since been surpassed by Avatar, which is not as good a movie.
No, not at all.
Not at all. So they bring up James Cameron, but James Cameron... Well, James Cameron's best movies are better than Independence Day, but not Avatar.
No.
We'll Aliens. Probably cover Avatar.
True Lies.
I've never seen True Lies.
True Lies is fantastic. I didn't see it myself for the first time until about a year and a half ago.
Excellent.
But it's wonderful.
Oh, an Independence Day video game was released in 97.
I remember that. It was because that was the first time that I ever really noticed that PlayStation existed.
Yeah, well, they released it also on Sega Saturn. Do you remember when that was a thing?
I do.
On PC. Each version receiving mostly tepid reviews. The multi-view shooter game contains various missions to perform with the ultimate goal of destroying the alien's primary weapon. I feel like I played that game at some point.
The PlayStation one?
I don't think I had a PlayStation at that point, but we were big Nintendo people back then.
Yeah.
I didn't get a PlayStation until years later.
Well, I'm just saying, I mean, I didn't have a PlayStation either.
Might have been for the computer.
Maybe I'm saying I played it on a sampler at Circuit City, back when Circuit City was still a thing.
Right. It was released on VHS on November 22nd, 1996.
Yes, indeed, and ended up in my stocking, as I mentioned.
Yeah, we don't have the DVD at my house, but I remember we wore out that VHS.
The VHS with the special kind of hot, that lenticular
that cover
front piece, so yeah. We can turn it and watch the White House blow up, yes, over and over.
Yes, that's awesome. I'd forgotten about that, but that is epic,
isn't it?
Oh gosh, this movie is just epic.
It is.
All right. Well, let's talk about this movie in terms of the characters now. We talked about how we actually think the effects and stuff are good.
We do.
The casting.
Oh!
I think that they hired actors more for their, like, reputation than for the character. Like, Jeff Goldblum basically plays how everyone perceives Jeff Goldblum.
Yeah.
Will Smith plays how everybody perceives Will Smith. Judd Hirsch plays how everybody perceives Judd Hirsch.
I wouldn't say that, because even at that point, Judd Hirsch, like, even now, like, when he's on Numbers, which actually has been canceled recently, but, I mean, even then, he's still so much more spry than the character he plays here. I mean, I remember watching Judd Hirsch on Taxi when I was young. I mean, I know Taxi was on in the 70s and 80s, but then he was also on a sitcom called Dear John that used to come on NBC. And the point is, like, that's the Judd Hirsch I know, a very right. young Jew man. And then in 96, they cast him as, like, the oldest Jew alive. And I'm like, that is not my Judd Hirsch. There's no way he got that old that
quick.
What
about Bill Pullman, then?
Bill Pullman. Not to be confused with Bill Paxton. He's Bill Pullman.
He's Bill Pullman.
Nothing against him. And I got to tell you, like, I know... It's weird. This is one of those movies that where I spend, you know, a number of years thinking that, like, oh my god, everyone loves this movie. It's like an indisputable classic. And then I find out that, like, there's this wealth of people who hate it, like, with a fiery passion.
Independence Day?
Yeah, and it blew my mind. And one of the things that people complain about, and this is the thing that really jarred me, they don't like the speech.
But it's a B movie.
And not only that, it's like so friggin' awesome because it's just like, it's like welling up, and then there's just like an ejaculation of soldiers cheering and the music rising and just like.
Well, I guess we've seen speeches like that in every movie.
Yeah,
like
but
this
it's
ever.
Fucking Independence Day. It's like, yeah, we're from Earth.
Imagine if that had been his speech.
Yeah, we're from Earth.
That would be if the president was played by Trey Parker.
Yeah. Oh, man, this movie might have been completely different with Trey Parker in it.
A lot of movies would be.
But anyway, who is that guy who plays... Yeah, James Rebhorn is Albert Nimzicki. He basically plays how everybody perceives that actor.
Yeah, well, because...
You don't really know his name or who he is, but when you see him in movies, you expect him to behave the way he does in this film.
There's a great documentary. I haven't seen it, but I've heard great things from my dear cousin, Stephanie C. Carnison, of Media Monkeys and Junkie Junkies fame.
Indeed.
Yes, she watched this documentary called The Face is Familiar.
Uh-huh.
It's a documentary about, like, character actors who most people know only by their face. So it's people like... I don't know if James Rebhorn was in there, but it's, like, people like James Rebhorn, like Danny Trejo, and, like...
John Capadese.
Yeah, like, people like that. You know the face, but you don't know... But by the face and by the roles they've played, you know them, because they always play that same guy. James Rebhorn always plays...
A weaselly...
Lanky, weaselly douchebag. John Capadese always plays exasperated, fat, tan man.
Right.
You know, Danny Trejo always plays, like, Mexican. So, I mean...
Oh, that was borderline racist.
It certainly was. He's pockmarked Mexican. Just a little more pockmarked than Edward James Olmos.
Edward James Olmos should have been in this movie. Opposite Mary McDonnell.
I tell you, if any movie could have predicted the awesomeness of William Adama and Laura Roslin, it could have been this movie. You know?
Yeah.
That's neither here nor there. You know, I have no idea how my episode is going to sound because I've been holding this computer up for a while. Now, see, you don't have to worry about it, Nick.
No, my fan's on.
Your fan's on, but your microphone is on top of your screen.
Is it?
Yes.
Hmm.
So you don't get the fan sounds on your episodes, but I do. I really apologize, listeners, for the fact that the fan continues to be the villain of our show.
Oh, we did mention Adam Baldwin, didn't we? Yes,
we did, in fact, yes.
Okay. And we mentioned Robert Loggia.
R, as in Robert Loggia.
O, as in, oh my God, it's Robert Loggia. B, as in, Bob, hey look, it's Robert Loggia.
Etc., yeah. Etc. I really don't know where to go with this conversation.
It's weird, neither do I, because, I mean, we covered almost everything I wanted to cover. Namely, your reaction to Matthew Perry almost playing Harry Connick Jr.'s part.
Oh, you wanted to talk about the alternate ending.
Thank you. And I feel kind of bad because I could have shown it to you. It's on the DVD. But this film has an alternate ending that maybe, that honestly would have made this one of the dumbest movies you've ever seen. So, I mean, this movie is 14 years old. Jesus Christ, 14 years. 14 years old, so I think if you don't know how this ends, then...
Do you really think this movie is going to end with the destruction of the human race?
Yeah, I mean, Russell T. Davies didn't write this, so...
Although, I made the quip in the movie, if Russell T. Davies had written this script, after the aliens were defeated, somebody would have been like, we wiped out their whole species. They were just trying to survive, and we killed them. And there'd be a moment where they're standing there in the sky looking grave. And then it would cut back to you know, celebrations.
Exactly, but that's not the point. The point is, this film ends, as most people remember, with Randy Quaid kind of having to be the guy who saves America from the aliens. He basically, you know, he drives his jet into the butthole of the ship and blows it up from the inside because his missile is jammed.
Of course.
Because that's not the point. The point is, in the alternate ending, which they have it fully produced and on the bonus disc of this special edition DVD, because you may remember back when like this movie came out on DVD in like 98, like all the commercials were like, this is the movie DVD was made for. You know, like... I'm surprised they didn't say that about Blu-ray, but anyway...
DVD came out...
In 97.
It became available on DVD on June 27th, 2000.
Whatever. The point is, I'm saying
97 was out. DVD was out in 97?
Yeah, when it started.
Oh.
I know. Only rich people had them back then. But anyway, Randy Quaid, as we know earlier in the film, he's a crop duster, quite often a drunken crop duster, who claims, and we can't confirm or deny whether or not this is true, that he was abducted by aliens 10 years before this, and that they, you know, probed him and experimented on him and turned him into a depressed shell of a man. And then the alternate ending, instead of, you know, being part of the Air Force with his own jet and everything and coming in to save the day, Randy Quaid, in an act of drunken foolhardiness, but successful drunken foolhardiness, flies his crop-dusting biplane into the ass of the ship with a missile roped to the side of the plane. He stole a missile, tied it to his crop-dusting plane, and shoved it up the spaceship's ass.
I assume they rejected him from the army because he's a drunken douchebag.
Probably. That's the thing. The alternate ending doesn't explain why it ended up that he wasn't with them and why he just showed up in his crop-dusting plane.
Well, according to the Wikipedia
page... Oh, you just found it?
The movie originally depicted Russell Case being rejected as a volunteer for the July 4th aerial counteroffensive because of his alcoholism. He then uses a stolen missile tied to his red biplane to carry out his suicide mission. According to Dean Devlin, test audiences responded well to the scene's irony and comedic value. However, the scene was reshot to include Russell's acceptance as a volunteer, his crash course, blah, 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 and him flying the F-18. Devlin preferred the alteration because the viewer now witnesses Russell ultimately making the decision to sacrifice his life. And seeing the biplane keeping pace and flying amongst F-18s was just not believable.
No.
So, again, this looks more like Devlin's work, reining in the random histrionics
the ridiculousness
of Roland Emmerich.
Yeah. Dean Devlin don't take no mess.
No, he doesn't.
Just like Papa. Papa don't take no mess.
Dean Devlin is Papa.
Okay.
Papa Dean Devlin.
Let's stop.
But yeah.
But yes, the alternate ending. Could you have imagined? And like I said, it is fully produced. The effects are fully fleshed out. You can watch it on the bonus disc of the original DVD release, which I've got. It's ridiculous. It's absolutely ridiculous. And there are a number of other deleted or alternate scenes, but the thing is about as I explained to you, the reason why I watched the special edition is because they put all the scenes that they cut out for, like, time purposes back in, and they edited them together pretty seamlessly. Like, I mean,
I couldn't really tell sometimes when it was a new scene, but I felt like a lot of the stuff that I could tell was new didn't really need to be in there to begin with. The scene where they're driving past and they find the guy, like, basically preaching Armageddon, you know, Vivica Fox.
Yeah, yeah.
That didn't need to be in there. El Toro.
Yeah.
I did kind of like the scene with Jeff Goldblum and the scientist inside the ship, though.
Yeah, I mean, that scene... I mean, it's not something that I ever complained about or didn't or noticed before, but I mean, without that scene, it could be feasible to have someone say, "Wait a minute, how do they know how to do all that shit?"
Exactly.
But instead, they figure it out here. And
I love Brent Spiner in this movie.
I do too, but I got to tell you, I mean, I'll tell you the truth. I've never seen a single episode of Star Trek Next Generation.
The couple of episodes I have seen bore me to tears, so I'm not a huge fan of Next Generation.
Okay, well,
I like the original.
But
series.
The point is, one thing I know about Brent Spiner is that apparently, as a person, is a real dickbag.
Oh, that's sad.
It's really sad, actually. Like, I remember someone said they were watching like the bloopers at the end of Master of Disguise, and he just wasn't having it.
Oh,
you know, he wasn't having the fun. And I know it's Master of Disguise, but you can't not have fun there, you know?
Well, it's a bad Dana Carvey movie, so...
Yeah. I just wish Dana Carvey made good movies.
Yeah,
I mean, because he... Dana Carvey just... He just needs to still be around, really.
Yeah. Where's he going, anyway?
He still does stand-up, and he's still around, and he shows up on The Tonight Show with Jerry Leno every now and again. And he had his own stand-up special again last... Or 2 years ago, like September's ago, because it was about a lot of it was about the election coming up. The bottom of my computer is very hot. I've got to find a way to start cooling this shit.
I thought you were going to buy
that thing.
That thing, yeah.
I was going to buy that thing, but as I explained, you have to have a big full size freezer, or it'll get folded up and won't work.
Right.
And because I've got a tiny personal freezer, and that doesn't work.
Oh, well.
This is all fascinating to our listeners.
I'm sure. You can probably cut that part out.
No, I don't know.
Yeah, exactly. We always say we might cut it out, and then we never do. Let's see. What's good in this movie? Well, I actually think this movie has some sublimely creepy moments.
Yes.
The beginning is really creepy.
The destruction of the moonwalking footprints.
Well, it's not so much destruction. It's just the vibrations from the traveling spaceship caused the footprints on the moon to, like, cause the, you know what I'm...
The sand.
The sand to jiggle, for lack of a better word, so that eventually it smooths out and there are no more footprints in there anymore.
Yeah.
And then there's the big shadow going across the moon. That's really effective, I think, and the music is really good there.
The music in this movie is great, just on the whole.
Yeah, it's by a guy named David Arnold, who does basically all of Roland Emmerich's movies.
And he's also done, I want to say, the last two James Bond movies?
Yep, yeah. He's done a lot more than two. He did a lot of the Brosnan movies. He might have actually taken over from John Barry when John Barry stopped doing them. I don't know how when John Barry stopped doing it, but he did all the big 90s James Bond movies and the new ones, too. So he gets around. He does a lot of action movies.
Yeah.
Anyway, I like the scene with the alien in the lab.
Yeah.
It's really creepily designed.
That's a scene that I never could watch as a child, I gotta tell you.
It's a really creepy scene. Just him moving around with... Just it moving around with those really rapidly moving tentacles and all the smoke. And then he presses Brent Spiner up against the window. And his voice shouldn't sound the way it does there. It's like this... It sounds almost like they electronically altered it. To release me.
Yeah.
Like, that's a creepy scene there. And, you know, I like that. I like that scene.
I like watching Adam Baldwin pump four bullets into that thing's head.
Adam Baldwin looks like a frickin' baby in this movie.
He certainly does. This is not the Adam Baldwin we know now, who's all psychotically Republican and ripped.
Yeah. It's sort of interesting.
Yeah.
let's see here. I'm not sure I bought that he would feel the need to implant the alien's thoughts into Bill Pullman's head.
I don't think it was so much that, like, it intended to implant its thoughts into Bill Pullman's head. I think it was more that just in the process of trying to kill Bill Pullman with thoughts, he just absorbed some of it.
Oh. I almost think it almost might have been better had they not explained it at all. Like, we don't even know why they're here. I love it when they don't explain things.
Yeah, but that would have actually... But see, that would have left us in a real Russell T. Davies kind of position where it's like, but we didn't even know! We didn't even know! Like, you know,
that's
like,
why everyone hates that scene at the end of Psycho where the psychiatrist explains Norman Bates being crazy. It takes...
I wasn't aware that people hated that scene.
Oh, everyone hates that scene. Because it's so dull and it, like, sucks the tension out of the room. Like, really? Now you're gonna just reduce it to this unspeakable insanity down to, like, this really boring scene of a guy just standing there explaining it? Like, really?
Right.
But... And that's neither here nor there for the purpose of this review.
Yeah.
We're 40 minutes in, though, roughly.
Yeah.
We got more out of this than we might have.
Yeah, I just, like, for what a big movie this is, I feel like there should be more to say, but maybe there isn't.
Maybe. Okay, then. What are some of your favorite scenes?
Favorite scenes for me? Honestly, I love Harry Connick Jr. in this movie because he's just, like, so ridiculous.
I've always liked Harry Connick Jr. I mean, this is the first thing I saw him in.
Yeah.
But I obviously forgot he was in it because I was like, really? Harry Connick Jr. in Independence Day? He was on Will and Grace for a long time.
Right.
And he's actually... Everybody knows him for the frickin' Suncom jingles.
Yeah.
And people, I think, have this impression of him as, like, a... wannabe Sinatra-style crooner, but he's actually a really talented singer and pianist and composer.
Yeah.
Just nobody really thinks of him like that because he's actually popular. And, you know, things that are popular can't be that good, so...
He was Michael Bublé before Michael Bublé was Michael Bublé.
Right, exactly. That's a great analogy.
Yeah.
But you like Harry Connick Jr.? I like him, too.
And I gotta tell you, like, having told you that it was almost Matthew Perry, I keep wondering, just like, how would this movie be if it had been Matthew Perry? I mean, I love Matthew Perry. I think it's wonderful.
I am just now gonna go to bed haunted by nightmares of how awesome Godzilla would be if Jeff Goldblum were in it.
I can't believe I never mentioned that to you before. It's really... Yeah.
Man, Jeff Goldblum.
Yeah, Jeff Goldblum, I mean, he would have handled the ridiculousness of, like, the scene where Matthew Broderick is explaining... Godzilla to the people on the plane. Mm-hmm. He would have made that so much more believable and interesting instead of, you know, yes, yes, the dawn of a new species, because I'm Broadway Matthew Broderick. Like, he's just like...
I don't think Matthew Broderick always sounded that Broadway.
He did after he went on Broadway. Like, you can tell there's a marked difference because, like, he does things like Ferris Bueller and, you know, Ferris Bueller. That's pretty much it. And then, like, he goes and does, like, what was that song, that show on Broadway? Torch Song Trilogy. He does that on Broadway, and then does the movie version of that, and then, like, never does another believable performance ever again, except for in, like, The Producers, because that makes sense. You know, like, he got to, because, you know, there's a difference between Broadway acting and Hollywood acting. And Broadway acting is much more broad. Way. And Hollywood acting is much more naturalistic, and he just lost it. But that's not what we're supposed to be talking about. That's from Godzilla. This is Independence Day, the film that preceded it.
Yes. You were telling me favorite scenes.
Favorite scenes.
I do want to mention just right quick that I love Jeff Goldblum.
How can you not?
He's awesome in this movie. Because he's basically just playing Ian Malcolm, but in a different movie with a different character name.
Jeff Goldblum is wonderful in pretty much everything these days. And
I like it.
I like it, too. what else is there to love about it? There's a lot to love about this movie. Just, we talked about the effects. You know I love destruction.
There's a lot of destruction there for fans of, you know,
you get plenty of it. You get plenty of it. I love, like, all of the random actors that I've heard of and nobody else has.
Yeah, you knew, like, everything in this movie.
Yeah, fucking the dude who played Brian Krakow in My So-Called Life kept popping up. I don't know his name. I think his name is Devin something. Hold on, is it up here?
I don't.
Fuck it, that doesn't matter.
One of those ones that we did.
But Brian Krakow trying to get laid off of Lisa Jacob, who, by the way, is Jewish and playing Hispanic.
That family is so bizarre.
It's a really bizarre family.
Like, I don't know. You say they're supposed to be Hispanic, but their ethnicities are very unclear.
Yeah.
It's like, I think they might.
I think Russell. I think Randy Quaid had sex with a Spanish lady, and thus we have these three kids.
But the daughter doesn't look remotely Hispanic.
Because she's Lisa Jacob and she's Jewish.
Right.
And she shouldn't be playing a Hispanic skanky daughter.
I know you were mentioning, though, that this movie is just a pastiche of racism.
Yeah, I mean, and a lot of people have accused Roland Emmerich of doing this in the past few years. Like 2012, there was pretty much like, here's an example of how a black person would handle the end of the world. Here's an example of Hispanics. Here's an example of Russian Paris Hilton. I mean, that was 2012. And here it is, you know, we start out with, who's the first person we see of our main cast? Shit, who is the first person we see? Probably the president.
Probably, yeah.
Yeah, so we have our crackers with the president and his daughter and all the people in the White House. And then we cut to the Jews with Jeff Goldblum and Judd Hirsch in the park playing chess. And then we cut to the Hispanics with Randy Quaid and his family. And then we cut to the blacks with Will Smith and Vivica Fox. And then in the middle of all of that, we have other things. And then we ended up with the British in Iraq.
With Jim Pittock.
It's the Americans. They're going to organize a counteroffensive. What do they plan to do?
Speaking of which,
you were not going with me on that at all. Were just ready to move on.
This is actually sort of interesting because it's tying into what you were saying about people not liking the speech. The nationalistic overtones of the film were widely criticized by foreign reviewers. Movie Review UK described the film as a mishmash of elements from a wide variety of alien invasion movies and gung-ho American jingoism. The speech in which Whitmore states that victory in the coming war would see the entire world henceforth describe July 4th as its Independence Day was described as the most jaw-droppingly pompous soliloquy ever delivered in a mainstream Hollywood movie in a BBC review. In 2003, readers of the UK's most popular movie magazine, Empire, which is an awesome magazine, voted the scene that contained the speech as the cheesiest moment of all time. Conversely, Empire critic Kim Newman gave the film a 5-star rating in the magazine's original review of the film.
That's really interesting.
So I guess, yeah, I mean, I thought that too, like, really? We're going to force our American holiday on the entire world. He went and put it in the speech.
But that's not the way I ever
addressed my concerns on screen.
But that's not the way I ever thought of it. Because you know me, I'm not rah-rah America. I think America sucks quite often. You know?
Right.
If I get in trouble for saying that, I'm sorry. I would much rather be British. But I'm just...
We all...
But I'm just saying, like, you know, I never took it that way. I just took it as, loved character actor Bill Pullman is yelling.
So actually, that's a pretty good job. But, you know, I was thinking, you know, if everybody was good at giving speeches as they are in the movies, the, like, history's list of great orators would include, like, James Whitmore for his stirring July 4th impromptu speech that he made up on the spot.
Yeah.
Like, all these people sort of make up these really inspirational speeches. Like, they're just supposed... They don't ever, like, deliver a speech. They're sort of making it up on the spur of the moment. I'm like, wow, these people are gifted speakers.
Yep.
Just a movie trope, I noticed.
Yeah.
So, that's that.
Bill Pullman.
Bill Pullman.
Could have been Jeff Daniels.
Oh, no. No.
But they starred together in Neil Simon's The Even Couple.
Neil Simon wrote The Even Couple?
No, it's from Family Guy.
Right. Why are they called The Even Couple?
Because they're so... Because Jeff... not Jeff Goldblum. Bill Pullman and Jeff Daniels are so, like, just Joe Everyman quiet guy. And...
Joe Everyman quiet guy.
Yeah. That sounds awesome. That sounds like a sketch from Sesame Street.
It does. Oh, look, on Wikipedia, they have the Time magazine cover for the with the film's creatures on it, and that's a pretty kick-ass cover.
Yeah, every time I go to this page, it always, like, jars me a bit. I'm not ready for it.
Yeah. I like the creature design, as I said.
Yeah, it's fantastic.
Anywhere else to go from here?
Have you told me your favorite moments?
Kind of. I said I liked the creepy moments.
Yeah.
I like the destruction of the cities. That's always
oh,
nice.
God, yes.
They fuel the need in me for destruction.
That was one great thing is I remember a couple of years ago they started putting like movies together in these big three packs that all had a, you know, a thematic connection. And I remember that they had a box set that was this, The Day After Tomorrow, and I want to say The Core.
The Core?
And it was called the Cinematic Destruction Collection, and I almost ejaculated in the FYE where I was standing.
That's awesome.
So
I would have liked for them to have not included two Emmerich movies in one three-pack of destruction.
Well,
not
I mean...
the only guy who does this.
No, there's Bruckheimer as well.
Yeah, Bruckheimer is maybe an even more bad filmmaker. That was a really badly worded sentence.
He's never directed a film, though. He's only produced.
Well, he produces a lot of bad movies.
Yeah, I guess.
Yeah. But anyway, I think I'm basically done. I mean, I said I love Jeff Goldblum already.
Yeah.
And I mean, Will Smith is Will Smith.
Yeah.
If you like Will Smith,
and I mean,
this like
was
this
was the birth of the Will Smith July 4th weekend we've talked about before.
Yeah.
Where, you know, he just took up residence on July 4th and popped out a bunch of box office gold and then started getting serious and kind of faded off, as
right.
he said.
Yeah.
So.
He I don't really see too much of Will Smith anymore.
He really needs another one of those kick in the pants, you know. Like I know he's now they're about to start making Men in Black 3, so that's going to do something for him.
Oh, Men in Black is awesome.
Yeah, Men in Black 3, you know, fucking, you know, him and Tommy Lee Jones doing stuff again. Josh Brolin is joining the cast
as Jay. No, he can't.
No. Jemaine Clement of Flight of the Conchords is apparently going to be playing the villain.
Not a fan of Flight of the Conchords.
That makes me sad.
Anyway,
yeah. We done here?
Yeah, I think so.
So, I mean, enjoy this film anytime, but enjoy it today. For today is our Independence Day!
Yes. I was actually surprised how much I enjoyed it this time. I thought maybe part of the reason I liked it so much was being so young, but no, it's just a genuinely enjoyable
movie.
It's
a great movie, yeah.
Yeah.
In fact, it's one of the best movies of all time!
It is.
Yes. So that's about it, right?
That is about it.
All right, sir. Shall we...
We shall wrap up now?
Yes, we will. And it's weird, you know, I think this will probably go down as the first time that we haven't had, like, you know, your episode ends and mine continues with a discussion of, you know, Independence Day's past. There's not much to remember about my childhood Independence Days. They were all pretty...
Nor me. Fireworks.
But yeah.
Hearing John Philip Sousa marches.
Yeah, that's about it.
Yep. Well, anyway, you've been listening to... A co-production between Cinemantics, the podcast about movies good and bad, and...
The original unoriginal podcast with its sub-series, The Best Movie of All Time.
I'm Nick Melton.
I'm Jeff Hedley. Go experience 7 days.
Good night, folks.
Okay.
Bob's Quality Roof Shingling. If you need your roof shingled, think Bob's.